Same place next Sunday. Till then, goodbye.
Sunday Morning with Susie Klein is a Perfectly Normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Mark Swartzentruber.
Pianist Mitsuko Uchida and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra give two concerts on consecutive nights in Performance Hall 3 from London's South Bank Centre. Featuring music by Beethoven. Orchestral and chamber music with Mitsuko Uchida and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra. Performance on 3, Thursday and Friday nights at 7 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Frances Fifield is a lawyer and a hugely successful crime writer. Her latest book, Cold to the Touch, joins a list I've counted about 25, I think, so far. Or is it more?
21.
Well, I think I did that because I was including some of the Helen West books which appear in two lists. And, of course, those became very familiar to viewers of television. The initial Helen West was Juliet Stevenson.
Yes, Juliet Stevenson did one very good one, probably the best version. Unfortunately, couldn't do any more.
And your love of music, Frances, will be known to Radio 4 listeners through your series Tales from the Stave, where you apply your forensic skills to composers' original scores, looking at the manuscripts and discussing them with various musicological experts. So does that interest go back a very long way?
I don't know really whether it did. It didn't feature too much in childhood, but I've always loved it whilst being really quite ignorant about it, or perhaps taken it for granted. There were other aspects in my life where love of music came out without my realising it, and doing kind of various jobs when I was training to be a lawyer, such as being a dresser backstage at Sadler's Wells. So with a different sort of understanding of music is simply something with narrative properties, really. I don't work with music. I can't work with music. It has to be music or nothing. But as I say, until I did radio programmes about it, I can't say that my knowledge was in any great depth, just something that was always there. And with quite a lot of sort of musical dislikes as well as likes, I'm afraid I was one of those kind of awful students who never really quite took to pop music, which is a terrible omission. But I didn't replace it with anything else until very, very much later. But the music I love is music with certain associations, really. And I find, as I get older, that the more I listen to a piece, the more you love it.
So if the music is something that's developed gradually, was the idea of being a writer important to you? I know that something happened when you were quite young, which must have had quite a profound influence on you, a murder nearby where you live.
Well, that was a very strange thing, of the police coming to the house. We lived in quite an isolated place in Derbyshire, saying, "Do you know anything about this body in the woods?" Which, of course, we being children just found as ghoulishly fascinating. And it was actually a girl who'd been hitchhiking up the M1, which was quite nearby, and had been somewhere abducted and killed in the woods. But it was very strange, the police coming to the house and asking my father, who was a doctor, you know, did he have an alibi for being one of the few people who used this particular road through the woods, and finding it all deeply sinister because you'd been walking there yourself not very long ago. I don't know whether that sparked anything off. I was more likely to be sparked off by my father being an anaesthetist and a specialist in pain relief. But that idea that anything so awful could happen in so beautiful a place was always, always stuck in the memory.
A lot of your central characters do exude a sort of quiet goodness. Is that something that you're drawn to?
Oh, yes. I think good people don't get a good press, really, in fiction a lot of the time, because perhaps sort of wicked or evil people are inherently more interesting, or certainly a good deal less inhibited. But I do like writing about quiet goodness. To me, the heroic tendencies, the nature of the hero is not somebody who is glamorously talented and all the rest of it. It's the ordinary person who is quite obdurate, obstinate, not particularly brave, not necessarily particularly talented, but faced with a dilemma and they have to overcome it. So I do believe very much in this quality of goodness, and I think it's extremely widespread, and I do like to celebrate it.
Well, it's certainly true in opera that most of the famous operas have got darkness at their heart.
Well, possibly it makes for better drama, doesn't it? Better contrast, darkness and light. The whole thing about making people laugh in the first act so that they're leaping out of their seats in the last. I suppose it's a mirror of life. There is always that contrast, that darkness, the things we were all raised with, demons and devils. And we do want to explore them and yet at the same time run away from them.
Your first choice is an opera, and I think it probably has as much to do with where you live as part of the time as with goodness. Although it always seems to me that the character at the centre of this is as sort of turbulent as the sea, which sort of mirrors his image.
Peter Grimes is this wonderful character who, to me, exudes the most enormous sympathy. He isn't a bad man. He's a mistaken man. He does the wrong thing. He's a clumsy, clumsy man, and therefore he's an outsider in so many ways. He just can't think quite the same way as other people. And he does do some terrible things. I've always got great sympathy for somebody who does something bad, whilst not necessarily being inherently bad. You know, he's bad to his employee, and he's clumsy, and he doesn't know how to get out of the situation. He doesn't know how to get out of it. And in the end, he has no choice and he's hounded down. And just, I weep for Peter Grimes. I've always wept for Peter Grimes because he loves the sea and it ruins him.
And of course, you're talking about light and shade, the contrast of those. What is wonderful about this opera is that there are depictions, like the one we're up against here, which are sort of joyous and absolutely celebrate the beauty of light on water, for example.
Yes, in this shimmering kind of way, which really does make me think of the sea. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I love this particular bit. But in this opera, he gets the sea in all its moods, just as he gets Peter Grimes in all the moods, and the populace of the town in all the moods, going from being actually quite kindly and well-intentioned and wishing to nurture, like the sea does, to being threatening and downright malicious.
And there is also a wonderful feeling of Sunday morning in this piece.
Yes.
I mean, not only by association, but somehow it does come to that.
It really does. That Sunday morning feeling, maybe you don't know whether the church bells have been and gone, but they're somehow there in the background, that Sunday morning tranquil feel. There is no work to do today, that there is something to celebrate, and the sea's letting you enjoy it and admire it. A feeling of tranquility in it, which I hope was true for all Sunday mornings, but and again, creating this wonderful contrast for what's going to follow.
Thank you.
really is the sea wearing its Sunday best.
It's a wonderful mixture of the secular and the sacred somehow. Sunday Morning from the Four Sea Interludes from Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten. In that recording, we heard the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by André Previn. We're going to stay with the sea, Francis Fifield, and I think a piece that you uncovered for yourself in your investigations when you were doing your Radio 4 series Tales from the Stave.
Yes, I think this one, the Hebridean Overture, or what we commonly call Fingal's Cave, was something that I'd always loved and certainly did listen to as a child, but grew to love very much more because of having the absolute privilege of seeing the original score and finding out sort of the story behind it, this great voyage towards Fingal's Cave, which is visible, actually, in the manuscript. It's a very neat, tidy manuscript. But Mendelssohn, very obligingly, this young man, he's only 20, he's on a jolly, he's on an expedition, a romantic expedition to find the Hebrides and the warrior king Fingal, as written by Ossian the poet. And it's very strange to think, as you know, these couple of German young men having this fascination with the Hebrides, greater fascination possibly than, you know, people south of the border here did, and going on this journey. And he, terribly obligingly, he's very visual. I think Mendelssohn is so visual that he takes a sketchbook. There are sketches, there are beautiful sketches and great passionate letters written home saying how wonderful it is and how seasick he gets. It's the great feeling of being on the sea, a feeling that it's all written in the open air. You get the sensation that perhaps it was, though I know that he penned the opening lines before he actually embarked. But I particularly love it because of this story behind it and these young men setting out from Mull to Staffa and being pitched about in the boat, probably in conditions which we would regard as deeply, deeply primitive now. But this determination and the wonderful thing that always comes across to me in Fingal's Cave, the great expectation is not disappointed. They're not disappointed.
I was thinking, as we were listening to that, and as you were talking about how sometimes being given the opportunity to explore something, like for a serious Radio 4, it's a sort of privilege, really, because you're being asked to spend your time, you've been paid to spend your time looking at something from which you learn and therefore enjoy music much more afterwards.
I can't tell you how I feel. It is the most enormous privilege. You know, I feel the luckiest person alive to be able to do that. I love the documents in themselves. Some of the documents are incredibly beautiful. But again, the opportunity to learn and to be with peerless musicians and enthusiasts.
The Hebrides Overture, Opus 26 by Mendelssohn, was played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. We continue with the Sea, Francis Fifield, and one of John Masefield's most famous poems. And this actually is a lovely song to sing. I did it as a student.
John Allen's Sea Fever. Well, I would never have been able to sing it, but I love the poem.
I do hear it being sung by a man, actually.
Yes. Yes, I did see a version of it on YouTube, actually, which was sung by a woman, and it was very, very wrong.
Well, let's hear instead Roderick Williams with Ian Burnside.
I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky. And all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by. And the wheels kick and the wind's song and the white sails shaking and a grey mist on the sea's face and a grey dawn breaking. I must go down to the seas again, for the call of the running tide is a wild call and a clear call that may not be denied. And all I ask is a windy day with the white clouds flying and the flung spray and the blown spume and the sea calls crying. I must go down to the seas again, to the vagrant gypsy life, to the gull's way and the whale's way, where the wind's like a whetted knife. And all I ask is a merry yarn from a laughing fellow rover, and quiet sleep and a sweet dream when the long trick's
Roderick Williams and Ian Burnside with Sea Fever by John Ireland. Words are probably a sort of music to you, and especially in terms of poetry.
I'm a wordsmith first sort of love of my life. Learning to read four was words and words ever since. So poetry, yes, and I wanted you to read this next bit, Cargoes, by John Masefield, because it's a sort of contrasting poem about the sea. Well, I love the sea in all its forms, really. I'm constantly homesick for it. I think I was born homesick from the sea, though I come from the Midlands. But I wanted you to read this poem just as a contrast to the last one.
Cargoes. Quinquereme of Nineveh from distant Ophir, rowing home to haven in sunny Palestine, with a cargo of ivory and apes and peacocks, sandalwood, cedarwood, and sweet white wine. Stately Spanish galleon coming from the isthmus, dipping through the tropics by the palm-green shores, with a cargo of diamonds, emeralds, amethysts, topazes and cinnamon, and gold moidores. Dirty British coaster, with a salt-caked smokestack, butting through the channel in the mad March days, with a cargo of tyne coal, road rails, pig lead, firewood, ironware, and cheap tin trays.
Well, I love that. That is the English Channel. It's a contrast to the romance of the sea. This is what it's for. It's a passageway. The English goods are nothing like as romantic as the spices, the diamonds, this, that and the other. It's the cheap tin trays and it's the dirty tug. Those are the sort of vessels that I really like. And I spend a lot of my time on the Kent coast, and that's what I can see from my window passing through the channel.
We're knocking off your passions one by one, I'm glad to say, Frances Fifield. Well, those that you're prepared to reveal, at any rate. And the next one really is linked to your love of 20th century art.
Yes. I think since whenever, I've always collected British 20th century art, perhaps slightly nationalistically, because it seemed to me for so long it was so greatly ignored and didn't really export too well. And so as a collector, I was able to collect it and to find it. We, of course, produce as much marvellous painting in the 20th century as other people did too. I love the late 19th. And I wanted this piece of music because there doesn't seem to be too many bits of music that are actually about paintings, but the excitement of seeing a painting which has to you what I call the zing factor that reaches out to you and causes this tremendous excitement when you see it. Having this great opportunity to see the world through somebody else's eyes. That's what painting is to me. And when you see something that you love, that excites you, there is this, well, I can't describe it, happiness, for want of a better phrase. If you can actually buy it and have it hanging at home and look after it, that might be even better. But also, the feeling of excitement before you go to an exhibition, not necessarily a big exhibition, a tiny exhibition, the anticipation of having this feeling of happiness, revelation, whatever you like, even if it's only to point at it and laugh at it nicely.
And here you get two composers for the price of one, in a way. The music we're talking about is Mussorgsky's Pictures from an Exhibition in the wonderful orchestration by Ravel. He suffuses the piano music with the colours of the orchestra. You've chosen The Old Castle.
Thank you.
I remember when I was collecting LPs as a teenager, the Cleveland Orchestra and George Sell always seemed to have something very special to say, and they certainly did there, in that recording of The Old Castle from Mussorgsky's Pictures from an Exhibition, orchestrated by Ravel. Just before we move on, Francis, tell me about some of the painters that you particularly like and collect. I mean, are there some pictures that you have that give you particular pleasure?
Yes, there are some artists. I love artists from the Bloomsbury Group, the Camden Town School. Duncan Grant, I'd say, would be a huge favourite. Vanessa Bell, that school, later on. But I have to say, some of the ones that have given me the greatest level of excitement, I call the Anons. You know, when you have found something, which is in its own right a beautiful thing, beautifully done with great talent, and it hasn't got a name on it. It will never be wildly valuable because it hasn't got a name on it. But it's still something absolutely exquisite, because the amateur artist can always, in the course of a career, rise to something absolutely wonderful. And that's what I like to find. The professional artist has to go up to that standard and maintain it all the time. But, you know, the not-so-good artists can, on occasion, rise to something wonderful. So that's perhaps what excites me most.
Well, we're going to have a visit to the opera now, and we're having some help, aren't we?
Yes, we're having some help. It may be a bit irreverent to represent a love of Mozart by this means, but I don't know how long ago it was when I was listening to Victor Borgia, who I think probably got a lot of people interested in music. But I like this take, the quick version of the Mozart opera.
I would like to take you to the opera where you are going to hear a Mozart opera, which is nothing but an opera written by Mozart. This is an opera in one act, and it begins when the curtain rises. Otherwise, you couldn't see a thing. The stage setting is a kind of a forest. There are two large trees, which, of course, indicates the forest. It's a kind of a small forest, but it's a forest. First, the tenor comes in. He is supposed to meet his soprano, as they usually call those ladies. But she's a little late this particular season, so he hides himself behind one of the trees in order to surprise her when she comes in a little later, which he does. So when she arrives, she can't find him because he is occupied behind one of the trees. Now, he's with a knife carving her name into the scenery. Now, she doesn't know that he is there, but, well, as a matter of fact, she must know it because she saw it during rehearsals. Either she pretends that she doesn't know it, or she's just plain stupid. Now, whatever it is, she gets across the stage somehow and takes place behind the other tree, which, for the occasion, hides her to a certain extent. Now, the chorus comes in, but nobody knows why, except Mozart, and he is dead. And that's just too bad. Next, her father comes in, and he is a very old man, primarily because she is a very old soprano. And he is very angry because apparently she is not his daughter. Now, this has nothing to do with the opera. I found that out myself. And that's what we call research. Anyway, he decides that he has had enough of her, so he tells her to die, and that's exactly what she's going to do. And with that, the opera ends, and people can go home. Now I take you to the opera house, where you hear the conductor's footsteps when he enters the orchestra pit. Here he comes. Yeah, he walks sideways. And this is the overture. This, ladies and gentlemen, was the first part of the overture. Now you hear the second part, and that's exactly the same. Now, this little blip is an extra blip we have in case we shoot one short of blips. But that has never happened, so we have a lot of blips left over. Now the curtain rises and the tenor arrives. He's a little tall fellow. He comes in. He comes in from the left in a single file. He goes behind the tree right away. Now the leading lady arrives. She is supposed to fill the part of the soprano. Now she not only fills it, she overflows it a little bit. He's a big he's a big soprano, that's what she is. She's what we call a messy soprano. She comes in a single pile. She also arrives backwards, but nobody notices the difference. She goes behind the other tree. She can hardly wait because... see, she is... She supposedly hasn't met him for a long time, so she's anxious. Now is the time for the chorus. And the light is dimmed, so you can hardly see these people when they arrive, and that's why they're dressed in a kind of cheap underwear. Because there is no reason to spend a lot of money for costumes when you can't see them. Right? And that's the way the management of this theater feels about it, and that's the way it's gonna be. Here they come. Bread and butter. Now they're all in, and they fool around in the dark for a little while. This is a mixed chorus. Bread and butter. Now they're out, they get the money and go home. Next, a baritone comes in and sings, Toreador, Toreador. But he finds out that he's in the wrong opera. Now, the father comes in, the old man, and he is the basso. Well, how low can a man get? Well, anyway, he has almost now told her what he had to say. And she understands him quite well. So now she prepares herself to die. But before she dies, she sings an aria, the so-called die aria.
Oh, must I die? Oh, must I die?
She seems very happy about it. She dies by stabbing herself between the two big trees.
The inimitable Victor Borge there with a Mozart opera. Well, I think, Francis Fifield, that maybe we better chase after that baritone who was at the wrong opera and see if we can find the right opera.
Yes.
Because that's coming next.
Yes. I suppose one of the most popular operas of all time, Bizet's Carmen, which I absolutely love, again, for its narrative thing, its ambiguity. Because it's one of those operas which is completely, this is a daft way to put it, but it's entirely formed by the music. The characters are formed by the music. It's sort of one long dance, in a way, a dance with fate. And I particularly loved the first act. Again, I got to know this better because I had the great opportunity of seeing the original score and a lot of the orchestral parts of this in Paris, where it's kept. You could see there had been lots of changes made, because the story behind Carmen was that it was commissioned for the Opera Comique in Paris, which is where they traditionally did musicals. And you would have thought, with this fantastic thing, with the tunes, they would have been spilling out of doors and absolutely adoring it. But they didn't. It was not a success on its first night.
Well, Bizet didn't live to know what a success Carmen was, which is so awful.
Yes,
thought.
Yes. He died 3 months later, one of these composers who dies young. But it's the idea that this wasn't a complete success because of the dark side. This renegade Carmen, this dangerous, dangerous creature who in the end, of course, is stabbed to death very abruptly in the last scene. And I loved it because one thing, when we were looking at the manuscript, we found a rather vital change had been made at the very end. So at the very end, Carmen is allowed a tiny bit more space than she is in the opera as we know it now. Change is probably made in rehearsal. There's a repetition. And the singer who was looking at it saying, well, there was an extra bit for me, we want it back. But the first act I love in this habanera, the narrative we have had on stage, the soldiers, we've got Don Jose, we've got the lovely, innocent Michaela who's been on stage, the creature of virtue, probably dressed in blue, sings beautifully and comes to remind Don Jose of his obligations. And then, after a little interval, in comes Carmen. And you think to yourself, when she comes in, and you know it from the music, you can visualise it, you don't have to see it, you know it from the music, as soon as in comes Carmen, Michaela, nobody else has got a prayer.
Refuser,
L'amour est un oiseau rebelle from Act One of Bizet's Carmen, the Habanera. We heard Teresa Berganza with the Ambrosian Singers and London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Claudio Abbado. We were talking earlier, Francis Fifield, about contrasts, and you mentioned your soft spot for showing the good in people. I must say, in the 2008 novel Blood from Stone, I was quite shocked in some ways by the behaviour of the prosecuting lawyer, and also some of the quite graphic details, severed fingers and sexual degradation. But of course, you do know about this because you acted as a prosecutor, didn't you, for many years?
Yes, I did for a number of years, a lot of murder cases as a prosecutor. In the case of this book, it's really the behaviour of the defence, which is pretty terrible. I was trying to write about what I know and what I have seen in the past, how a trial can go completely and utterly wrong. Not because people are shocked by it, but just somehow the wheel comes off. You can begin with the really, really good evidence and it becomes distorted and just all sort of fades away.
And could a barrister get away with that kind of cruelty in court?
Yes, they could. I can't write what could not actually happen. They could. They would not be terribly likely to if they had a good, solid judge. But there is a point somehow in trials, like there are in books and other things, when everybody just gets totally demoralised. And then terrible things can happen. Yes, it could. I don't like to think that it could, but it could.
We're going to return to the sea. Mm. And in fact, a very famous sea hymn, which has even appeared in operatic guise, Eternal Father Strong to Save. It's a wonderful tune, apart from anything else.
It's a wonderful tune. I mean, I was brought up with quite a lot of religion and with a bit of an aversion to hymns, which I overcame in later life, but only certain sort of hymns. And I just love this one. Again, it goes back to the love of the sea, and it's a prayer for brave men. And it was at my father's funeral, so I wanted it for him. He always loved it. But it was one of the first hymns that made me think, you know, hymns could be good things instead of rather dutiful things, and some of the best tunes. Was it Wesley who said he couldn't bear the devil to have the best tunes?
Eternal Father, Strong to Save, words by William Whiting, music by John Dykes. We don't often credit the composers who wrote those wonderful hymn tunes. The choir of Liverpool Cathedral, joined there by massed choirs from Merseyside, conducted by Ian Tracy, with Ian Wells playing the organ. Well, Francis Fifield, thank you very much for introducing us to these pieces of music that clearly mean a lot to you. I just wonder which direction you're going in now. What can we expect from your pen in due course?
Well, hopefully another book with a departure and new characters in, which I am in the act of rewriting because it rather went in the wrong direction and has to be pulled back into course, and I hope it will be finished soon.
Well, many a composer has said it's not what you keep but what you throw away that makes the...
I think it's true across all the creative arts. It's very, very much important what you leave out.
Thank you very much, Francis.
Francis Fifield was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the interior designer Nikki Haslam. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall. Well, we just heard the choir of Liverpool Cathedral, and we'll be hearing them again at 4 o'clock this afternoon in choral evensong. It's another chance to hear Wednesday's service. That's 4 o'clock, followed at 5 by Discovering Music.
Weekday afternoons on BBC Radio 3. Mussorgsky. Mahler. Massenet. And more. Join me for Afternoon on 3 as we hear the BBC National Orchestra of Wales at the height of its powers with some of its eminent conducting team. Weekday afternoons from 2 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's a minute after one. Time for the news with David Cornett.
Police in Northern Ireland investigating the murder of one of their officers suspect that dissident Republicans were behind the killing. 25-year-old Ronan Carr, who was a Catholic, died when a bomb exploded under his car yesterday as he set off to work at Enniskillen Police Station. The Chief Constable of Northern Ireland, Matt Baggett, called the killers a potent and dangerous minority. The First Minister of Northern Ireland, Peter Robinson, insisted that the murder wouldn't deter Catholics from joining the police service. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has restated that the former Libyan Foreign Minister, who fled to the UK, Moussa Koussa, hasn't been offered immunity from prosecution. Some victims of IRA bombings, which involved explosives supplied by Libya in the 1980s, want Mr. Koussa prosecuted. He's also been accused of involvement in the Lockerbie bombing. Mr. Hague told the BBC that Mr. Koussa wasn't under arrest, but that he hadn't been given any guarantees. Two Afghan police officers are reported to have been killed in a third day of protests against the burning of a copy of the Quran by a pastor in the United States. The latest deaths were in Kandahar, where 10 people died yesterday. In Ivory Coast, troops fighting for the winner of November's election, Alassane Ouattara, are said to be planning a further push to take control of the presidential palace. They aim to oust the former president, Laurent Gbagbo, who's refused to accept the election result. Reports say French troops have taken over the airport in the main city, Abidjan. Here, the government is to launch a new drive to sell its plans to voters for the NHS in England, amid concern at the lack of public support as well as opposition from some Liberal Democrats. It's expected that there'll be a number of changes to the legislation when it returns to the House of Lords, including measures to prevent private health providers cherry-picking profitable NHS services. And the weather forecast is for sunshine and showers. The showers are likely to be heavy and thundery in places, particularly in central England and Wales and towards the southwest. Temperatures ranging between 10 and 14 degrees Celsius. BBC News and weather at 3 minutes past one.
With David Cornett. Well, at 5 in Discovering Music, Stephen Johnson joins the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and the conductor Alexander Titov for an exploration of Rachmaninoff's symphonic dances. Before that, as I said, Choral Evensong at 4 and Radio 3 Requests at 2 o'clock with Chichi Nwanuku. But it's time now to join Lucy Skeeping for today's edition of The Early Music Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. That was a little galliard played by an old friend of mine, the lutenist Christopher Wilson. We were at the Royal College together, and as a mere violinist in those days, I think his lute was probably the first one I'd ever seen, close up at any rate. It's such a pretty sound, and it's an instrument that would certainly have been very familiar to the composer of that galliard, Alfonso Ferrabosco, an Italian who worked in England at the Elizabethan court on and off for some 16 years. An investigation of Ferrabosco immediately brings up a large and complicated family tree that dates back to the 1400s, to Alfonso's great-great-grandfather Domenico, who served at the magnificent house of the rulers of Bologna. He doesn't seem to have been a musician himself, but the family was to spawn at least three of them, a father and son and a cousin. And in today's programme, we're going to be focusing on the lives and the music of these three 16th century Ferraboscos. Alfonso, the oldest of them, was one of eight children. Like some touring theatrical clan, they all travelled with their parents to wherever the work was, to Rome, where their father sang in the Sistine Chapel choir, and then to France. Alfonso was still only about 12 or 13 years old at this point, but his new home must have impressed him. It was the palace of Charles of Guise, a powerful cardinal who surrounded himself with poets and intellectuals. And it wasn't long before he had the three young Ferrabosco brothers singing for his guests, who were evidently mightily impressed by their sweet tones. Gesture and sound and voice together, like three Apollos singing gently to the lyre, twittered the posh poet Pierre de Ronsard after hearing them. So the trois Ferrabosques Italiens, as the French called them, were wheeled out whenever music was required, which included performing at the wedding of the Dauphin to Mary Queen of Scots, who incidentally was the cardinal's niece. But by the early 1560s, at the age of 19, Alfonso decided to spread his wings and travel to England. And it was here, as one of the Queen's musicians, that he composed the two viol consorts we'll hear now.